Hello there. Today is Thursday, October 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president declares his actions in Syria a big success, but some experts say it is the complete opposite.
We have done them a great service, and we've done a great job for all of them.
A chaotic scene as Republicans storm a secure intelligence committee hearing in protest of the impeachment inquiry. Also ahead, a new report finds that sometime in 2020, Africa may be declared polio-free. It's all on today's International Edition. In an address from the White House on Wednesday, President Trump said Turkey had announced it was making last week's ceasefire permanent, allowing the United States to immediately lift sanctions imposed in response to the cross-border assault. And despite harsh criticism of his retreat from Syria, including from leaders of his own party, Trump defended his decision.
The same people that I watched and read giving me and the United States advice were the people that I have been watching and reading for many years. They are the ones that got us into the Middle East mess, but never had the vision or the courage to get us out. They just talk.
The president said his decision saved countless lives, and he also said ISIS fighters have been detained by the Kurds and are under complete control.
ISIS is under very, very strict lock and key, and the detention facilities are being strongly maintained. There were a few that got out, a small number, relatively speaking, and they've been largely recaptured.
Well, but a hearing Wednesday on Syria, House Foreign Affairs Chair Elliot Engel says President Trump has given America's enemies a gift.
It's safe to say ISIS is celebrating President Trump's foreign policy right now. He's handed them their biggest victory in over 4 years, but they're not the only ones rejoicing. Assad regime forces in Syria, backed by Iran and Russia, are now filling the vacuum left by America's withdrawal.
Well, President Trump seemed to declare victory in Syria, saying it's pretty amazing what has gone on recently with no U.S. lives lost. Earlier, I spoke to Presidential Medal of Freedom recipient Ryan Crocker, who served as United States Ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. Thank you so much for being with us, sir. The president touted great success and victory over his decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria, but there are many others who say that this was actually a grave mistake. Where do you stand on this?
Well, what has happened over the last week or so in Syria is many things. From our perspective, almost all of them bad. It is in no way a victory for the United States. Turkey has obviously gained. They got an American green light from the president to move into northern Syria and essentially to break the back of our ally in the war against the Islamic State, the Kurds of Syria. He has badly hurt the United States military. Our service members do not join and do not deploy in order to leave allies in the lurch in what is basically a retreat under fire. He has benefited the Syrian regime, Bashar al-Assad, helped to strengthen a partnership between the Assad regime and Russia, and of course he's benefited Russia, and he has benefited Iran. So from a U.S. perspective, all of our adversaries are in a better place. We and our erstwhile Kurdish allies are in a very bad position. So I've come to see over the last years that when President Trump talks about a victory, he seems to be aligning himself with our adversaries, in this case, the entities and governments I just named.
Why do you think he made this decision?
It is very hard to tell why the president makes the decisions he does. He seems to act on the spur of the moment without advice or counsel, following his own worst instincts. He has no grasp of international affairs, and as we have seen in this case, I don't think he understands American national security. And when the president of the United States does not understand our vital national security interests, which in this case revolved around diminishing the strength of the Syrian regime, checking the Russians, checking the Iranians, He's done the exact opposite. So sometimes I wonder what country he thinks he's president of, because he's acting more like the leader of Russia than the leader of the United States.
The president said that the situation with all these ISIS prisoners, I believe there were like 11,000 of them in Kurdish custody. We have heard that more than 100 have escaped and there's no idea where they are at the moment. But the president said just a few got out and they've all been recaptured. What is happening, or what is likely to happen with ISIS at this point?
At this point, of course, we really don't know what is happening with those Islamic State detainees, because we're not there anymore. What is certainly a fair assumption is that the Kurds are no longer mounting a stringent guard on them, because the Kurds, after our betrayal, have been running and fighting for their lives. So is it just 100? Is it many more? Will it be many more? Again, we don't know at this point. But given that there is nobody minding the store any longer at that camp, I think we have got to assume that those who want to get out, presumably all of them, are getting out. And in this sense, he has given Islamic State a huge gift, basically a new lease on life. They will be back. They're not there anymore. Our Kurdish allies are not there anymore. We cannot look to the Turks and to the Russians to carry on a campaign against Islamic State. They have shown for the last 5 years or so that they don't really care about Islamic State.
So you're saying that this is breathing new life into ISIS and they could become a much bigger threat now?
Well, I am quite certain. They will be back. They know how to go to ground when they have to. They are committed to their cause. They will be back because of, again, the president's actions. They will be back sooner and stronger than would otherwise have been the case.
So what does the U.S. gain from all of this, or what happens with the U.S. standing, with its military, with the world, with allies?
Again, what has just happened in northeastern Syria does not stay in northeastern Syria. The president has signaled to actors around the world that we will not stand with our allies. Do not count on the Americans. Similarly, he has signaled to our adversaries, be patient, wait, play on his lack of understanding and his impatience, and you will get what you want. So for a global power, we have now done ourselves global damage with both allies and adversaries.
What's next for the Kurds who fought alongside Americans against ISIS? What, will they ever realize that they have a home and safety and support?
Well, enormous damage has been done to the Kurds. You know, they had already paid a huge price in the anti-Islamic State campaign, over 10,000 dead. Now, of course, the entire Kurdish community in Syria, men, women, and children, are in the gravest of danger. The best case I can imagine right now is that the Kurds will be successful in coming to an accommodation with the Bashar al-Assad regime. We saw that was their first instinct in the face of our betrayal. They may be able to get a modus vivendi with that regime. They are both minorities, the Alawis of the Assad regime and the Kurds, both concerned about a common potential threat, which would be the Arab Sunnis. So they may be able to come to a modus vivendi with the regime, but at terrible cost. And in a manner, they are the weaker party, to say the least, in such an effort. If they do come to an accommodation, they're going to have to pay for it. But that is their best and only chance since we walked out of them.
The entire ramifications and consequences of this decision of the president to pull the U.S. out of Syria, will this take years to really unpack as to how to really see what it created? Will it take years? And is it possible, if someone else gets elected in 2020, to fix any of it?
What has happened over the last 2 weeks is going to play out over several years. This war is not over. Peace is not breaking out all over Syria. We have given the advantage to our adversaries, certainly. We have weakened our friends. But we will be dealing with the consequences of it for a very long time to come. And we will do so from a position, again, of strategic weakness that our adversaries are going to continue to exploit. So there will be developments that I cannot imagine and cannot foresee as this moves forward. What I am sadly fairly confident of, none of these developments are going to be to our advantage.
What would you say to your colleagues who are diplomats around the world to, you know, reassure them that what they're doing is meaningful?
What I would say to them is stay the course. Do not let this administration and this president run you out of the Foreign Service. A capable Foreign Service is more critical now to us than ever. Sooner or later, there will be change in Washington. And at that point, the requirement for active, thoughtful, effective American diplomacy will never have been higher. In the interim, stay the course. The taxpayers have invested a lot in our Foreign Service, language training, the area specialties, and so forth. This is a dark time, but precisely because it is a dark time, it's very important that the good and the best stay in the arena.
All right, that is Ryan Crocker. He served as the United States Ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. Thank you so much for being with us. U.S. President Donald Trump and his supporters in Congress are seeking to undermine Democratic-led efforts to build up enough evidence for the president's impeachment. Trump dismissed impeachment. The impeachment inquiry is just another case of a witch hunt against him, and most Republican lawmakers are disparaging the process as secretive and undemocratic. But as VOA's Latika Hulk reports, the new testimonies on the administration's dealing with Ukraine gave pause even to some Republican lawmakers.
In his address to a conference Wednesday in Pennsylvania, the president glorified his energy policy and U.S. economic growth, referring to the impeachment only vaguely as part of a general criticism against the Democrats.
They can't beat us at the ballot box. They cannot beat us at the ballot box. So they want to try and beat us the old-fashioned way, which is not very nice. They are a nasty group of people.
The remark came just hours after a turbulent morning on Capitol Hill, where a group of Republican lawmakers stormed a closed-door deposition in the House Intelligence Committee space. The lawmakers were not members of the congressional panels conducting the investigation and had no right to demand entry, but they argued that the case was too important for the investigations to be held behind closed doors.
We are trying to have some transparency to this process. I represent nearly a million Floridians who are asking me my thoughts on this process, and yet I can't relate to them anything except what's being leaked to the media.
The disturbance delayed the scheduled deposition by several hours. Critics say the upheaval was created to distract public attention from the damage inflicted by a deposition given to lawmakers Tuesday by former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Bill Taylor, the highly respected career diplomat handpicked by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, confirmed a whistleblower's allegation that Trump linked U.S. aid to Ukraine to the country's willingness to cooperate in an effort to damage Trump's political rival.
In my 10 short months in Congress, it's not even noon, right? And this is my most disturbing day in Congress so far.
Taylor's lengthy testimony gave pause even to some of Trump's own party members, prompting an angry tweet by the president in which he says the Republicans who do not support him are worse than the Democrats. A federal judge ordered the State Department on Wednesday to release Ukraine-related records, including communications between Secretary Pompeo and President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Botswana elections have started with a very strong turnout. Hong Kong legislators have formally killed a controversial extradition bill that has initially led to months of mass protests. Facebook's CEO tries to allay congressional concerns about its planned launch of cryptocurrency. And Russia is seeking stronger and more positive ties to Africa at the Sochi summit. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, a new round of intra-Afghan peace talks will be held in China next week, raising hopes for renewed negotiations even as violence continues and the surge of Afghanistan's 18-year war. The talks were revealed by a Taliban spokesman who said the two-day meetings will be held next week. A UN envoy also said this week that agreed. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talked about it with Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director and Senior Associate with the Washington-based Wilson Center, and asked how these talks ended up being held in China.
Well, you know, it's the story of China and its role in Afghanistan and its interactions with the Taliban is quite interesting. This will not be the first time that there will have been engagements between the Taliban and China. China over the last few years has very quietly engaged with Taliban representatives. China has a very strong interest in the war ending in Afghanistan. China is building this Belt and Road Initiative, as you know, this huge transport corridor across the road. And for it to succeed, it's going to have to pass through Afghanistan in some way. And obviously, it's hard to, you know, be building roads and infrastructure in a country that's at war. So China has tried to do what it can to increase the likelihood that there can be some type of launch of a peace and reconciliation process leading to an end to the war. And so that's really why China in recent years has reached out to the Taliban and tried to help convince them that it would be the right thing to do to agree to talks with not just the United States, but many players. And in this particular case, Beijing is going to try to enable the Taliban to launch this broader intra-Afghan dialogue in which you can have efforts to build a consensus among the Afghan people for what the proper path forward is to get to a peaceful outcome.
So I take it that an official delegation from Kabul will not be part of these talks. Is that correct?
That's as I understand it, yes. And, you know, the Taliban has been pretty consistent that it will not be willing to participate in any type of intra-Afghan dialogue at which you have government officials. It's sort of suggested, the Taliban has, that it would be willing to have present government officials if they're there in their private capacity. Now, what that means exactly is not clear, but I think particularly in this case, given that, as you know, there was just an election in Afghanistan some weeks ago and the results haven't been announced, so the government is really a lame duck anyway. So I really don't think that the Taliban would have any interest in there being any type of Afghan government official there.
What about the U.S. government? Does this write the U.S. out of these talks or not?
Well, I think it is interesting that China and a number of other countries that have tried to facilitate these talks with the Taliban, these are all countries that are rivals with the U.S. You know, Russia has hosted some talks like these. Iran has as well. So it's almost like you have these efforts on the part of Afghanistan's neighbors, those that don't get along with the U.S., to try to sort of undercut the U.S.'s own efforts to launch and in the current context, relaunch some type of talks with the Taliban. I think that it really should be seen as a good thing. The U.S. should see this as a good thing that China is meeting with the Taliban, because I think it's important for any actor out there that's willing to try to do whatever is necessary to incentivize the Taliban to be willing to sit down and hold negotiations. I mean, anything is better than the war at this point. However, the U.S. government is a strategic rival of Beijing's, and it's not going to like anything that China is doing that may seem to be competing with what the United States is trying to do. And of course, in this case, it's the fact that the U.S. is also trying to get the Taliban to the table to relaunch this talks process that's been on hold for almost 2 months now.
All right. That's Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director and Senior Associate with the Washington-based Wilson Center, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Ending polio has been a long haul. The global campaign to eradicate the virus has been going on since 1988. And while it is close to eradication, it is not over. Sometime in 2020, though, Africa may be declared polio-free. But as we hear from VOA's Carol Pearson, the disease is hanging on stubbornly in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And as long as it hangs on, it can spread globally.
The global effort to end polio is a massive program. It relies on global funding, volunteer vaccinators, negotiations with political and religious leaders at all levels, and parents who have faith in the vaccine. In Kenya, facts about polio are taught in schools. Children are even taught what to tell their parents.
What kind of advice can you give to the parents? Yes?
If his or her child does not get vaccination, he or she may be sick or be paralyzed.
Yes.
Clap for him.
The international efforts are paying off. The prevalence of the disease has declined by 99.9%. Nigeria had its last case of polio 3 years ago. Nigeria and all of Africa may be declared polio-free sometime in 2020. There used to be three strains of the virus. Type 2 was eradicated in 2015. Health officials now say type 3 has been eradicated as well.
This will be the second type of three types to be eradicated, leaving only one type that continues to circulate in the world.
It's here, at the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, where large numbers of people cross from one country to another, and where the wild polio virus spreads. Protecting migrant children from getting polio is a full-time job. Both countries saw cases increase from last year.
But the reality is, you know, both countries are essentially one epidemiological block. There's so much population movement. The same virus family is being ping-ponged back and forth across the border with population movements.
And that is the main challenge. People have families on both sides of the border and visit back and forth. A second challenge is that the Taliban now allows vaccines to be given only at immunization centers. Still, another challenge comes from the program's success. The number of cases has dropped dramatically, and the eradication program now has to address other urgent needs like clean water. But Pandex says the program has always adapted.
UNICEF, in particular, has a strategy for both Afghanistan and Pakistan to provide these complementary services. And Rotary, for many years now, has been working with Coca-Cola in Pakistan, providing water filtration systems in some of these highest risk areas.
Those involved in the Global Polio Eradication Initiative have traveled a road that is longer and harder than was expected in 1988 when the program began. It's far from over, but the partners in this campaign have not given up. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition, back in a minute.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
The VOA's International Edition continues. Well, when astronauts orbit the moon or live on its surface in the decade ahead, they will probably be inside inflatable space lodges that are now in development. Dozens of NASA officials and veteran astronauts are wrapping up a review of five space habitat mock-ups built by different companies. VOA's Jim Randall has a look at the results.
The U.S. space agency NASA is examining several design ideas for Gateway, the planned research outpost in lunar orbit. It will also be a temporary home for astronauts waiting to travel to and from the moon's surface, or perhaps Mars. The mock-ups look like balloons, but they are far more complex.
The Gateway, which is a lunar staging ground where we're going to aggregate the lunar vehicles to go to the lunar surface, and then maybe in the future aggregate the Mars transit vehicle. So it's a sort of a co-orbiting platform and lunar vicinity.
Inside the habitats are things needed to accommodate research, as well as facilities needed for humans to live and work. Experts are studying the mock-ups to see which design works best.
The whole point is to define what we like and don't like about these different habitats. And from that, we will aggregate all the data and come up with recommendations and even requirements for what we actually want to go to flight with.
The push to design and build space habitations grows out of the Trump administration's effort to have NASA put astronauts back on the moon by 2024. The accelerated timeline spawned the agency's Artemis program, which calls for the privately built Lunar Gateway, as well as lunar landers and robotic rovers. The modular space station orbiting the moon will house research and people. This gathering took place recently in Las Vegas, Nevada, at the headquarters of Bigelow Aerospace, a space habitat company founded by hotel chain billionaire Robert Bigelow. He hopes to host guests in a whole new way.
Gateway is an opportunity to test all these structures and in a deep space environment, so to speak, even though it's so close to home, as a prelude to going to Mars.
Bigelow's B-330 habitat, launched from Earth compacted inside a capsule, is made of a fabric-like material designed to shield inhabitants from deep space radiation and high-speed space debris. Once docked alongside other Gateway modules in lunar orbit, the habitat unfurls into a two-story, 16-meter-long outpost that can house up to 6 astronauts. The Lunar Space Habitat and Colonization Program is expected to cost more than $1 billion through 2028. Jim Randall, VOA News.
Ringo Starr, one of the only two living members of the world-famous Beatles, is out with his 20th studio album. It's called What's My Name? It's a bundle of positivity and cheer with a handful of good tunes to boot. The music has Starr's usual energy and the simple but persistent message of his peace and love. It was recorded at his home studio with a familiar cast of friends like Joe Walsh and Edgar Winter. What's My Name continues Starr's practice of including some sort of Beatles connection on his albums, a guest from a Liverpool friend, and a song one of them wrote. Starr's take on his sincere feelings and Paul McCartney's typically melodic bass playing is also prevalent. With the All-Star Band, his 30-year-old touring extravaganza currently making the rounds once again. And What's My Name is another sign of Starr's seemingly boundless enthusiasm and love for his music. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. I'm not afraid to
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.